following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler, best-selling author, actor, and lead singer of Fozzy. Now he's rocking the podcast world.
Yay!
This is Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. I am your host, Chris Jericho. Welcome to the show. Jerichoholics worldwide, how are you doing? Thank you so much for listening this week. We got Bret Hart, second part of the Bret Hart interview. It's funny, though, because when I called him, he said he only had 60 minutes, but we were talking so well that I didn't tell him that we were going to do it for two shows. I was trying to keep him on the line. It was like when you see one of those spy shows when you have somebody on that you're trying to tap the line and find out where they are, and you go, just keep them on the line as long as you can. That's what I was trying to do. So, Bret, I got two great shows with him. Had a little bit of feedback issue. I think there was something wrong with the phone line, but bear with me. It's still a great episode, and it's like working at a bell factory. After a while, you don't even hear the bell ring anymore. So if you have a little feedback issues, I know about it. I'm sorry. Happens sometimes. Didn't want to cut off one of the greatest world champions ever and ask him if he had a landline, although maybe I should have. See, that's the things I can learn here on Talk is Jericho. But you're going to love the show anyways. Last week, we talked about so much great stuff. We talked about his dad, Stu Hart. Didn't actually do the imitation of Stu Hart, but it was like,
you bastard, and you're kind of a big guy, 250.
So that's kind of Stu's voice was kind of like that. Great guy, very influential, amazing promoter, and what a character, one of the greatest, most reviled characters in pro wrestling history. Had to have him back, though. Wanted to talk more about his WWE time, talk about his WCW time, which he does not pull any punches. I believe the word he uses is that Eric Bischoff is an idiot. But if you haven't checked out the first part of our conversation, download it at podcastone.com. Click on Talk is Jericho, or you can go to iTunes and subscribe to Talk is Jericho. Then it's just delivered to your iPhone or whatever you listen to this show on every week. Doesn't get much easier than that. Also, if you have a question, hit me up at Talk is Jericho. Throw a hashtag on that, TIJ questions, and I'll answer anything you want. Later on in the show. All right, got a little spoiler alert for you. Talking about Sons of Anarchy season finale. Okay? It's a spoiler alert. I got people mad at me because I gave away the finish for Dexter on the Nerdist a few months ago. Listen, if you haven't watched the show yet, it was 2 months ago. You can't be going out in public or listening to pop culture podcasts if you haven't watched the finish of some of these shows. You know I like them. So this is a spoiler alert. I'm now going to reveal what happened. Final scene. Unbelievable. Gemma murders Tara in cold blood. I couldn't believe it. I was freaking out. Now, it's funny because they see each other in the kitchen. They go face to face. And it's kind of like this standoff. And then, bang, they both run at each other. And then Gemma just starts kicking Tara's ass. And I'm like, okay, Tara's going to make a total comeback here. But she doesn't. Because then Gemma just like she boots her in the stomach and then throws her in like this sink filled with water and Tara's drowning. And they're like, okay, now she's going to do something. Then Gemma picks up like this two-pronged, I don't know, turkey cutter or something and starts stabbing her in the back of the head. Like, it was the worst. Like, are you kidding me? Just stabbing her in the back of the head and eventually kills her. Now, Sons of Anarchy is famous for having these very gruesome, I guess you'd say, scenes. They had one where a guy was getting the tattoo on his back, the big, what do you call it? The big back piece, I guess. They burned it off with a blowtorch because he wasn't in the gang anymore, so he had to get rid of his tattoo. And then there was they castrated the child molester, or when Tig's daughter got set on fire right in front of him, like, oh, just the worst stuff ever. But Tara getting stabbed in the back of the head, I mean, I can just feel it. It hurts right now. Just gouging with this. And then Juice comes in and finds Gemma over the body of Tara. Now, Juice had just been told by Jax that he's betrayed him and basically he's going to die. Jax is going to kill him. So Juice is like, all right, I'm not going to help you out. I'm going to take care of this. And now Gemma owes Juice huge and might save his life. Then Jax comes in, finds the dead body of his wife, just gore everywhere, cradles her in his arms, and then the cops come and find him. Now, Jax was going to have to go to the police station to turn himself in to save his wife from going to jail. Now, his wife is dead, and the cops think he's the one who killed her. What is going to happen to Jax and all of the wacky cast of Sons of Anarchy? I don't know, but Sons, definitely one of my favorite shows. Rarely disappoints. There's only one bad season. I didn't like the Ireland season, if you guys have seen that. But now, Sons of Anarchy, one more season, and then it's done. Which, to me, is okay because, once again, like Dexter, like Breaking Bad, like Walking Dead, we're watching these shows because we know that it's not going to end well for these people. It's not going to be a good ending for any of these people. Now, The Walking Dead is a little different because they're good guys for the most part. But Dexter, Walter White, and Jax Teller are all criminals. I mean, sure, Jax is noble because he's getting away from gun running and drugs to just deal with prostitution. But seriously, if this guy moved in next door, you would run screaming, screaming, screaming from him. So you know it's not going to end well for old Jax Teller. It certainly didn't end well for Tara. She got stabbed in the back of the head. What a turkey pick, yo! I don't even know what a turkey pick is. You gotta love it. I love the fact I can talk about all of this stuff here with you on Talk is Jericho. All right, Bret Hart is coming up.
All right, for the
second week in a row, Bret Hart is here on the show. Very, very excited to have him. Last week, we talked all about Stampede Wrestling. We talked about the initial run with the Hart Foundation. And now we're back for the second week in a row. Bret Hart is here. Very excited to have him on. So we're talking about when you and Neidhart were together as the Hart Foundation. Huge act. I mean, very, very popular. But you mentioned earlier that you went to Vince for years and told him that you wanted to become a top guy. When was the decision made and how was it made to kind of split you guys apart? And was there always a plan for you to get to that next level? I mean, obviously, they gave you the chances for it. But did you think you would ever make it to becoming the world champion when you first split up with Neidhart?
No, I never had any big grand plans. I was always working hard and always trying to climb the ladder. You know, we got stuck together as a team and did really well as a team for 6 years. I wouldn't have changed anything. We had some great matches and great chemistry, and we drew some pretty good crowds. Like, we helped contribute to the business at that time, which was roaring fire back then, and you know, we did our part, and we were real happy with those 6 years. And then I think you do climb the ladder, and you do watch a lot of guys come in and other guys cut in front of you, and sort of you keep waiting for somebody to throw you a bone. And I was there 6-7 years and never got a bone really, other than tag belts.
Right.
And when we lost the tag belts, which was we sort of knew was a sort of a limited thing, that they had promised me for about the third or the fourth time that they were going to give me a big push in singles by myself, and they were going to split us up.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, okay, well, I'm waiting for that. Just let me know when you're going to do that. And so then they took the belts from us and said, okay, now we're going to make you a single guy. And they told me to come up with a submission hold. And eventually, I was the one, I think, that came down myself, put the scorpion on, or a version of it or whatever. And,
right.
Vince said, we'll call it, I think Vince is the one that said he liked the sharpshooter as a name. And we sat around and kind of just talked about it. But that's what we kind of have me in mind for a single push. And, you know, because sometimes you can read the writing on the wall. And whenever they turned me babyface and kind of gave me a push, they usually pinned me. Like, I didn't go anywhere. Like, my big push went nowhere. And I mostly just jobbed out for Bad News and different guys, or Dino Bravo, and then they throw me back in the tags, and I never really got a push. And I think one of the things that they felt about me at the time is that I couldn't do promos.
Uh-huh.
I probably couldn't do great promos, but I was getting better with the experience that I was getting over the years. And I know that when Kurt Hennig had won the Intercontinental title at in L.A. at WrestleMania 7, and they came to me the next day and said, we're going to put you with Kurt, starting right away. And I said, I don't want to work with Kurt. you just got the title.
Uh-huh.
Why would I want to work for the curtain? I said, well, you're going to have great matches. And I said, you guys promised me a big push. I said, whoever works for the curtain's got to put them over.
Oh, right.
You're going to give me a big push and stick me to the curtain and just have me drop out again. And then I missed the chance, you know. And
right.
I said, you guys promised me a big push. I need to get my hand raised the first time I go out this time rather than go out and get clobbered the first time I go out as a babyface. And I remember I stood my ground on it. I refused. I said, I want to work with Kurt. I'm not working with him.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, yeah, I remember Pat was like pleading with me. It's going to be great all summer. And I said, I just knew. I said, it's the next guy that works with Kurt is going to get the title. I didn't tell him that.
Yeah.
I said, I know that whoever works with him by the time he gets to SummerSlam, they're going to switch things around. And whoever the next guy to work with Kurt is going to be the guy that
gets the title.
That's the guy to be, not the first guy.
Interesting, yeah.
And so they end up switching things around, and they threw Davey in with Kurt. Bulldog got what he needed was a push, too, at the time, but they gave him a push with Kurt. And about June, they came up to me and said, you're working with Kurt at SummerSlam. And then they told me I was going over.
Ah.
and I kind of got the push. I think Kurt did a lot for me. Kurt went to bat for me and I think offered to put the belt on me. I said I deserved it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Kurt could have just, he had injured his back already and could have just taken the injury thing and gone out. And I don't think Vince would have any problem with it. But Kurt actually came back just to put me over. I heard him tell me, I came back because I wanted to do that to you.
Wow.
You did it for me. I helped put Kurt over and get him over when he got his first push with Vince.
You know, it's interesting. When I was in WCW and there was such a quagmire of political BS, Kurt was the one guy or one of the few that always worked hard with me and with the guys in my gang and always did his best to put us over and to help us out. And, you know, Kurt was that type of guy. You know, he definitely believed in, you know, I don't know if passing the torch is the right word, but of definitely passing the knowledge along and keeping and doing things for the good of the business rather than the good of himself.
Kurt was a guy that loved working. He loved the good work. He was not a guy afraid to go out there and, you know, bust his ass for a small crowd or a small town, you know, where as long as he liked to work with a good opponent, if somebody wanted to work, he was a good dance partner. I always thought Kurt was one of the safest guys I ever worked with.
Safest?
You could lie there and let Kurt do anything. He was always such a pro. He was one of the best, safest guys I ever worked with.
You always had that reputation too, though, Brett. You never hurt anybody from what I remember.
No, I never. I take great pride in that. I know I never hurt anybody. There's no wrestler that I ever worked with that didn't get up the next day and work again.
Yeah.
I think that has a lot to do with being the best there is, best there was, best there will be. You know, it's kind of a big boast to make about yourself, but I can sort of wear that banner proudly because I never injured one guy. And I wrestled 300 days a year for almost 23 years. So there's a lot of matches, a lot of bodies that lay there underneath my knee drops. A lot of guys that took my punches and stuff like that, but nobody ever got hurt.
You mentioned the best there is, the best there was, the best there ever will be. Where did that come from, and did you think of that?
It came from the movie The Natural, Robert Redford.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I came up with it on one of those TNT shows back a long time ago with Vince. And I remember Vince was I was really nervous, and I remember Vince asked me a question on the show, and I tried to be cocky and kind of show that I could be on TV kind of thing. And I remember I said something about the Hart Foundation being the best there is, the best there was, and the best there will be. And I just remember that's like my first, I noted in my head as my first tagline.
Oh.
And then me and Jim started using it for Hart Foundation back in the early days. And then when I went single by myself, I kind of just kept it,
It became a catchphrase for you. You know, it's interesting, too. You mentioned about how you got your initial push with the Intercontinental Championship. It's amazing how belittled that title has become over the last 10 years or so. Back when you were there and when I was a big fan, the Intercontinental Championship was the second most important guy in the entire company. I mean, you had basically Hogan and then whoever was the IC champ. You made that such an important belt to the point where you guys even headlined at Wembley Stadium. You and Davey Boy Smith with that Intercontinental Championship. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I always thought the IC belt was kind of considered the wrestling.
Yes, right. The workers' belt. Yeah.
The workers' belt. Yeah, and the guys that had it were always good workers for the most part. Good, solid, hard-working guys that like Tito and Greg Valentine and Pat Patterson. And, so I there was a great history behind that. But Pedro Morales, I think, was another guy that really made that belt. I think Chief J. Strongbow and one. Anyway, the belt always meant something. I always thought it did in the New York territory. Anyway,
sure.
And I know that for Wrigley, I remember telling Vince in August. Months, maybe even June or July, maybe July of that year. I told him, I said, we should go on last. And he said, you think you can carry it? I said, I don't think I want to be the match that goes on after us. I said, nobody, not one match will be able to follow us.
Wow.
And he goes, are you sure about that? And I said, I'm absolutely 100% positive. And he changed it, put me in Davey on top.
Who was originally supposed to be on top? Who was the champion
I
at the time?
I think it was Warrior and I'm thinking Macho Man. I think wrestled.
Okay, yeah, because Warrior was probably the champion at that point.
And it was a good call. There's no way that anybody on that card could have topped that match that night.
Right. Well, especially Davey being the hometown or the home country hero for sure.
It was a funny thing, Chris, I don't know how often you in your life you can sense how things are going to go. And I was really over in England and Germany back then, super over. Like
right.
Way more than I was in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually was more over than Davey in the UK. And
oh,
I
wow.
knew it.
Yeah.
And Davey was really over.
Yeah,
but I knew as soon as they put me against Davey that the fans, all those fans that I had, they would have to sort of go with Davey because it's a national pride thing. I just knew that going there and wrestling Davey, that people wouldn't really think about the match too much,
uh-huh.
Bret Hart versus Davey, until we actually got to the ring. And when suddenly you see Bret Hart and you go, geez, Bret Hart never loses. He's Intercontinental Champion. He's, I was over at that point, and I know that they fully thought that I would win the match. But at the same time, they're going, Bulldog Wrestling in England, Bulldog's going to go over. And so I think when fans see him and I look at each other in the eye at the beginning of the match, the first time they've really thought about it, it's they saw the billing, they're going, yeah, Bret Hart versus Bulldog, and it's like, wow,
right.
Who's going to win? They don't, there's a big question mark into what the finish is going to be. And that's what I loved about that match at Wembley was the... It was such a great story to tell. Two baby faces, one and one being from England, and just that whole drama that we told. I always think it was one of the most powerful matches I ever had.
Is it one of your favorites?
Oh yeah, for sure. I was always a stickler for details and stuff like that, and. I thought it was such a great match, and I was so proud of it when it was over. And I remember telling Davey before the match, I said, Davey, at the very end, I'm going to make out like I'm going to throw like the poor sport kind of attitude, and I'm going to stomp off back to the dressing room. And I said, no, I won't shake your hand. And I refuse to shake your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, when I refuse to shake your hand and start to leave, I said, you're going to see, I said, I think we could make 90,000 people start crying if we milk the handshake.
Right.
Where you just keep looking at me with the sad puppy dog eyes, like, just, hey, I'm sorry to beat you, it was a good match, just shake my hand.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I'll keep making out, like, I'm going to get mad, and I'll keep leaving, and finally I'll come back. And I said, by the time I shake your hand, and come back and shake your hand, I said, we can make them cry. And I remember when we had that match and it was all over, I kept looking at Davey to milk the handshake, and he kept looking at the crowd and looking at Diana, and I kept going, for God's sakes, just look at me.
Yeah.
look me in the eye, and we'll have everybody in this building, like in this arena, just ready to start crying.
Right.
He would never look me in the eye until I finally just walked over and hugged him, and we never got that moment.
Oh.
It's like one of those little details. It was such a great match, and it was such a great drama, and it's the little details sometimes that can make it that much better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the case. And it's interesting that you mentioned that because I had Steve Austin on my show a few months ago. And I asked him, what's your favorite match? And we talked about it. His favorite match was WrestleMania 13 versus Bret Hart. And the reason why I'd even brought that up in the first place was that, to me, was the best example of the crowd didn't know they wanted you as the heel and Steve as the babyface until you gave it to them. It was the best double turn in the history of the business, in my opinion.
You know what else was that I always look at is that it was so... Like, the fans are like rabid dogs, you know, they're just, the violence is so, when I look at UFC today, and I go, people that watch UFC, they want the knockout, they want that
bloody, yeah, they want the car crash, NASCAR.
They want all that violence, and it's like, I look at WrestleMania 13, and it's like, I gave you all that without, except for no animals were harmed in the making of this movie, you know, like, you know, no faces were punched, and teeth knocked out, and black eyes, and you know, I'm so much more proud of my career and my accomplishments in my career, in knowing that I was a pro wrestler and that I didn't have to make a living as a UFC fighter, and where I had to really punch out my friends for real and beat up people that are my friends and peers. And it seems to me that's a really tough, hard way to make a living. And, you know, but I want to watch WrestleMania 13 is, that's the beauty of what pro wrestling is. People that are sort of nonviolent pacifists and stuff, I think, appreciate wrestling more because, you know, there really, most of the time, there is no animals harmed in the making of the movies. And, you know, the match with Steve Austin was such a brilliant story and a great battle. And what I always love is the little details in that match. Like, there's a part in that match where Steve Austin kicks me in the balls. And I take the bump backwards, I just fall backwards. But it's just so real. Like, it's just so intense, so real that you go, I don't know how, I mean, when I watch it, I go, it's some great, great stuff. And Steve was a great, great wrestler. I loved working with Steve. And I missed working with Steve after I left the company. I would have loved to have played more of a part in his career.
In the ascension. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. It was almost because you left was one of the reasons why he grew. They had to build him quickly. And I think 13 was the perfect time for his turn. You obviously sensed it. The other great part of it, too, is when Shamrock pushed you and you didn't push him back. That was like such a pussy thing to do. You know, it was like such a great, great, great moment in wrestling history for sure.
I remember when I cocked my fist like I was going to drill him.
Yeah.
You could fear the whole building was about ready to come crashing down. It was such a rumble. It wasn't supposed to be anything between him and me. Vince said, make sure, because they'll lose sight of who you're working with.
Like, right.
If you do too much with Ken, it takes away from what you did with Steve. So we just wanted to kind of plant a little seed that maybe if Shamrock wanted a piece of me, I could give him a piece of me kind of thing. It was great. I loved it.
How was it working? One of your other programs that I loved that you did was the one where it was brother versus brother, you versus Owen. How was that working with him and kind of being one of the reasons that Owen finally got his shot and finally got to show off his real talent was basically because he was working with you?
Well, you know, Owen was a really good wrestler right from the start. I think much like me, he grew up watching it, and we both got established in wrestling pretty young. Like, you know, I was working on top for my dad within 2 or 3 years in the business. And Owen was working on top for my dad within a few months of being in the business. And, you know, I worked hard trying to get Owen into WWE because I used to see a lot of guys, even in the late 80s, I used to see a lot of guys that were, you know, not, like Owen was every bit as good as Sam Houston or Paul Roma or, you know, Jim Powers or any, there's lots of guys. Like, bring my brother Owen.
Right.
So I was always working on Owen's behalf, and they did bring him in a couple of times, but they didn't really did much with him. I was the one that actually was the one that told Vince to bring him in and call him the minute mass gimmick name, like Blue Blazer, and sell his hoods like Rey Mysterio with us now. I said, you'd make a fortune selling his mask, and you make him a real cool character. And Owen does all this high flying and all that stuff, but, you know, Vince had so much other stuff going on at the time that they shut the they kind of killed the Owen when they brought him in. They brought him in just to be a bottom guy, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Bring him in to be a big high flyer star. And so Owen kind of died on the vine, and he left, and I got him back again a year or two later, and they kind of did the same thing again with him. But didn't really give him, I think Owen got hurt a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
He never quite got the big push. And, you know, one of the strange things is that Owen had come to me right around the time I had the SummerSlam with Doink and Jerry Lawler, where I fought them both on the same pay-per-view at SummerSlam.
Right.
But it was on that same weekend, I think, that Owen had told me, because he was quitting the business, and he was going to become a fireman.
Okay.
And he was just waiting for the scores back on his exam that he took to be a fireman. And I felt bad. I go, geez, you know, Owen's a really good wrestler. And I remember talking to Vince at that time, and Vince was telling me he was so short of talent. He couldn't find any new, fresh talent. He was having trouble finding new stars and stuff. And I said, well, you're going to lose one that's going to quit because he just gave up on being here. And mm-hmm. I said, I think it's such a shame that you don't do something with Owen. He's quitting and become a fireman. And I said, I'm just saying that. And he goes, we'll try to think of something for Owen, and maybe we can talk him into staying. And I remember we had a long talk about Owen. And it was the very next week that they came up to me and said, we want to work a storyline where you wrestle your brother Bruce.
Wow. Originally it was Bruce.
And I go, I don't think I can wrestle my brother Bruce, A, because he's... but B... I just knew Bruce had just had knee surgery, like big knee surgery. He hadn't wrestled in about 5 years, and before that he couldn't wrestle very well anyway.
Right.
And it was really going to be a labor of love trying to work around my brother Bruce, who had a pot belly and was about 40 years old. And it was just not going to work. But they were set on Bruce. And I remember I said to Vince after we talked about it, I said, no, I will not even consider doing it with my brother Bruce, but I'll consider doing it with my brother Owen.
Oh, okay.
I said, you probably, I came in here a week ago and asked you guys to think of something with him, and you come up with another idea for somebody else, you know, in my family, but the wrong one, you know. And,
right.
You know, the truth is that Bruce was injured and couldn't have done it anyway. And, you know, the part of the story that was told to me is that they wanted my brother Bruce to come out and challenge me, much like Owen did a few months later, a few weeks later. But Bruce keeps challenging me, and I won't accept. I won't fight my brother Bruce until finally Owen comes out and goes, you know, Bruce, you've been a big mouth since all your life, blah, 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 and you've always been a troublemaker or whatever. Why don't you fight me? I'm the youngest in the family. So Owen would challenge Bruce and was going to, I think, work with him at the Survivor Series or the Rumble or something like that. And then Bruce was going to mop the floor with Owen, totally annihilate Owen and destroy Owen. And then I was going to come out and I was going to be so angry at what he did to Owen that I'd go, okay, I accept the match now. And then me and Bruce would wrestle WrestleMania.
Wow.
And that was originally what they had in mind. And I remember when I said, Owen will never go for it. And I remember called Owen, I said, this is what they had in mind. I said, Bruce goes through you to get to me. Owen told me, I'd quit. I would have quit.
Yeah.
I would have quit on the spot. And, you know, it just, it's funny how things went. Owen and I, we never wrestled each other. We had one match somewhere early in a tag match somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Owen, when we first set out to work at WrestleMania 10, you know, we didn't have any chances to work together. Owen was primarily a babyface, a high flyer. He did a lot of great stuff off the top ropes and all this kind of high flying stuff.
Right.
I remember we kind of had a couple of test matches where we had tag matches. I think it was me and us. Might have been me and Scott Hall against Owen and Shawn Michaels or something like that. But we had a couple of matches where we got to try different spots out, but we didn't really get to perfect anything other than certain moves and kind of get used to each other's style. And then we got to about 2 days before WrestleMania, and we kind of worked out a whole match, a really good match. I often wonder now, like from the visual standpoint, if you could watch the match that me and Owen had originally planned out, it probably would have been a better match than what we had.
Really? Why is that?
Well, we just had all his high-flying stuff.
We gotcha.
Had so many great high-flying,
yeah,
detailed, complicated high spots out of coming off the top, and a lot of great stuff that Owen hadn't really had a chance to show people that he knew.
Yeah.
And so we had it all down, and I remember I called Owen up on the Friday. I think we were leaving for New York City on Saturday, and I called Owen. I said, "You better come up to the house. We got to talk." And I realized in watching the matches back and remembering the reactions we got in the towns that we were working in, Owen would do some of this stuff, and the place would go crazy. They kept popping on stuff. And I said, "Owen, you're turning heel, and you're going to do all this high-flying stuff." I said, "By the end of the match, they'll be cheering. You're like a baby face."
Right.
You know, we got to be really careful with how we do this. You want to be a heel, you better be a heel, you know. And we totally tossed out the match and put a different match together where Owen was much more vicious, much more devious, and, you know, he was a real cutthroat, like in the sense he did everything he possibly cheat to win, do everything from biting my fingers, kicking me in the crotch. You know, and it's what got him over. Owen had so much heat within a few months of WrestleMania, and it was the right call. We had actually had a really good run. It was one of the first times WWE did big business after WrestleMania. Usually there was a big drop in business, but that was one of the first years that business stayed up because I stayed on the road and Owen was a red hot heel.
Yeah, it was such a good match, too. It's funny because a lot of people talk about Michaels and Razor, the ladder match they had. But for me, the best match on that show was always Brett versus Owen. And it kicked off the show, and it was hard to follow it. You talk about trying to follow a match like that. The story was amazing. It was kind of Owen's coronation. It was a great moment for sure.
Yeah, and it was really hard for two wrestlers that had never worked with each other. And a fairly complicated storyline in that sense from a worker's standpoint, how to bring out the best for the story and the match. The two guys that never worked with each other, I think WrestleMania 10 stands out as one of my greatest accomplishments. It was really hard to do. And at the same time, still be over at the end of the night when I won the title and
yep.
Still have Owen over as a red-hot heel. And it was a really well-executed storyline.
Hey everybody, Steve Austin coming to you from Podcast One Studios in Beverly Hills, California. I got Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Boom, love the bagpipes. And I used to play them like Jack Benny. Just total actual torture to boo me. They start booing. Don Owen stops me. He says, "Now, I can't play the bagpipes, and neither can you."
Download it now at podcastone.com.
You're listening to Love Advice with Leanne. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Leanne. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Why, in your professional opinion, do you never take my calls off the air?
Is this Carl?
Yep, it's Carl. I mean, we had a few dates. Everything was great, I thought.
Well, you know, when you switch to GEICO, you could save a lot of money on car insurance.
Okay, awesome.
You should call them.
I will.
GEICO, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
You're listening to Talk is Jericho.
Welcome back to Talk is Jericho. We're here once again with Bret Hart. Let's talk quickly about your time in WCW. How was that for you? It's interesting for me because I went the other way around. I went from WCW to the WWE, and for me, it was like the Wizard of Oz. And WCW was black and white, and then when I opened the door for the WWE, it was a whole world of color, and the whole landscape was different. How was it for you going reverse from the color into the black and white?
Just like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, I knew right away, and I knew it before I ever got there, that the only thing that WCW couldn't buy, that they couldn't attain, was somebody with any brains. It was, and you're a good guy to talk to, because you know, and you and me conferred with each other a lot in those days, but then talk about idiots running the, what a bunch of morons. But Eric Bischoff was one of the most stupid idiots I ever met in my whole life. I think back on it now, and I look at what happened with the business and where it went and what the potential was of the industry at that time and the wrestlers that ran it, especially in WCW. There was so much talent. They were on par with WWE as far as talent. If anything, Vince had to rebuild and remold and reshape a lot of his characters to catch up to WCW in 97.
Yeah.
They had so much talent, from Rey Mysterio, and you were a talent, and Benoit was a talent, and Booker T was a talent, and Kurt Hennig and Macho Man. There was so much talent everywhere. And that Eric Bischoff was such an idiot. He couldn't do anything, and he couldn't stay. I shake my head today, and I go, what a shame. What a shame. All the millions of dollars and all the, you know, where this business could be today is great that Vince has got a monopoly and controls every aspect of the business. But, I mean, the wrestlers today have no bargaining position. They got no leg to stand on. They take what they can get, and that's it.
It's interesting to me when you're talking about, Bischoff and the way he did things. I didn't understand when you left the WWE, you were the hottest property in the business. I mean, the two biggest characters in the business were you and Vince. And Vince obviously took what happened and ran with it one way. And when you came in right from the start, it was almost like a burial. How obviously you must have known that or felt that from when you first came in. What do you what happened when you first came in? Were you promised something different from what they actually did with you?
Well, you know what? I was so, like, when I left the company, I left WWE, I knocked out Vince McMahon, I beat The Undertaker at SummerSlam, I had cheated and basically never lost to Shawn Michaels at Survivor Series. I couldn't have been more hot. I had beaten everyone from Steve Austin at WrestleMania 13. I was at the peak of my career. I had nothing but one good pay-per-view after another that year. I was as hot as I could ever be. And they brought me in, and they killed me off, I think, right off the bat. And that was Hulk Hogan killed me off automatic. Yeah. And I didn't know it at the time, and guys told me later on, and I've since figured out that Hogan put a knife in my back the second I got there and made sure that they never did anything with me. Just sat me on the bench the whole time I was there. I used to make $30,000 a week.
$30,000 a week?
More than that. I think it was $33,000 every week, rain or shine. And I'd work. Most of the time I didn't even work. I was the most insane thing. They'd fly me. Eric Bischoff would fly me down from Calgary all the way to somewhere, all the way across the country. I'd fly first class. I'd land, they'd have a luxury rental car for me. I'd stay at a five-star hotel. I'd get to the building. I'd wait around all afternoon talking to guys like you and Benoit about how stupid things were there. And about 5:30, they'd come out and tell me that I was off the cut, that they didn't need me on the show. And I'm sitting there thinking, there's another day off my 130 days or whatever I've got to work for these guys. But, I mean, I wanted to work. I wanted to make a difference. I saw lots of guys I could work with. I would go to Eric Bischoff every couple of days and go, how about putting me with Booker T, or how about putting me with Benoit, or how about sticking me with Kurt Hennig? And, you know, Bischoff, most of the time, he would shoot down anything you brought to him.
Yeah.
And he'd give you the stupid grade one logic of someone that doesn't know anything about anything, logic about, oh, we can't do that because the sky's blue. And, you know, it was always like, I'd always walk out of his office and go, that isn't even a reason why not to do something. But he's, you know, he's so stupid and afraid of exposing that he's an idiot and that doesn't know what he's doing. He reminded me of the guy on Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, making all the noise and pulling all, but he didn't know anything. You know, and I remember Vince McMahon talking to me before I ever left for the company, about a year before. He goes, WCW would never know what to do with a Bret Hart.
Yeah.
And, you know, it always echoed in my head, and I always knew it. I agreed. And I never, ever did want to go there. I was actually kind of sad that I ever ended up there.
Right.
But, you know, I look at everything that I did at WCW was basically a sabotage from the time I got there to make sure I just didn't do anything, make sure that I went nowhere.
Well, it was so amazing because that was kind of the MO for the company. I mean, anybody that actually ever got over was just squashed. I mean, it happened to me. Eddie Guerrero was the hottest heel in the company about 6 months before you got there. They squashed him. At one point, Kidman was a huge babyface. They squashed him. Like, if you were able to squeak through the cracks and get over in spite of what was going on, you'd get punished for it and buried. I just never thought they would actually do that with you. But like you said, there were so many bosses there. everybody had a target on their back, and here comes Bret Hart from the WWE, the hottest star in the business. We have to squash him.
Yeah, like, who would take it? Like, I don't know.
I look at
say, me and Hulk Hogan could have drawn big money.
Absolutely.
Right off the bat, they could have just brought me in the hook with Hulk Hogan. You know, right off the bat, we could have done
huge business. Huge numbers. Hogan was the biggest heel at the time. You could have come in as the biggest babyface. I mean, that's just money on the table.
And I, you know, even when I left, like even when before I got hurt, I can remember, like you remember when I wrestled Goldberg? Were you still in the company when I did that thing with Goldberg in the steel plate in Toronto?
Yeah, in Toronto, absolutely. Yeah,
that was such a good idea.
Yeah,
like, you could explain that to someone in the dressing room, and it made really great television sense. Where you go, God, that would look so good. That'd be so
great. What it was for the people at home is that Goldberg was doing the spear and speared Bret and was knocked out, and Bret pulled up his hockey jersey and had a steel plate wrapped around his abdomen.
And it was such a brilliant little idea, and Goldberg was indestructible at the time.
That's right.
It was so, and he came out of the dressing room. Everybody thought, well, oh my God, here he comes, Goldberg, Bret Hart. I was so over in Canada. It was so great, and it was such a great finish and such a great surprise at the end. And if you only knew the backstory of how hard it was to get that idiot Eric Bischoff to go along with it, let me do it.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of people say that was the best thing you ever did in WCW, and it was the best thing I did in WCW. And it was probably the only thing that we did, and it was so hard to do.
Yeah, they got lucky, I think, with kind of stumbling onto the whole NWO thing, and that's basically what took him to the next level. And I also, too, like you said, there was a lot of talent in WCW, like our gang of guys. I think all of that contributed to WCW's ascension, but it didn't take long for them to start hemorrhaging money because of the dumb decisions they made, and bringing you in and just basically doing nothing with you was the one of the biggest, I think, mistakes they made.
You know, I'll say honestly that I remember I never had a chance to work really hard for that company. I wanted to work hard, and I never got much chance to do it. But I do know that the guys that were working hard and gave that company the reputation that they had for great wrestling were guys like you and Benoit and Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio. They were the real workhorses. There were some guys that worked really, really hard and were great workers and hard workers. And you know, they never got their credit until they left. You know, I can remember, you know, just WCW was such a chaotic mess of bad ideas.
Yeah. Well, like you said, there's no reason, there's no mystery as to why they went out of business. But, you know, you mentioned you got kicked by Goldberg, and that was kind of the end of your career. You made amends with the WWE. How is it for you now with Vince in the WWE? You still work there from time to time, making appearances, et cetera?
It's good. I have a good rapport with them now, and I'm glad I came back. I forgave all that stuff with Sean and Vince. And, you know, I think it was good for everybody. You know, I think everybody, after all the smoke and after Olin's tragic death and everything that happened, I think everybody just felt really bad about it, everything.
Right.
Including Vince, including Sean, everybody. And, you know, I know I didn't feel very good about anything. I'm glad that, you know, that I was smart enough to realize that the best thing to do. After I wrote my book, I realized that I said everything I wanted to say and needed to say. And, you know, it didn't do any good to.
Yeah.
To have a chip on my shoulder. And I think that's what I left everyone with after my book, was that I was a bitter, kind of resentful of the business in general and stuff like that. And I thought, I love the business and I love the guys in it. I'm very grateful for everything that Vince did for me and the chances that he took on me. He took chances on me that Bischoff and Hogan and those guys never did with me. He's the guy that really, he was the only guy that ever gave me a chance. And I owe a lot to Vince, and I feel bad about my own part in things, in the sense I wouldn't change anything I did with that whole screw job stuff. But I mean, I'm sorry that I let things get to that point too. I think I certainly threw my share of gas on the fire, and I think Sean had his problems then. And,
yeah.
You know, in the end, you know, I remember Sean, once upon a time, was a really good friend of mine. And I think that's what made me think about kind of bury the hatchet, was you know, maybe we can make friends like I used to be with him. And you know what? Sean and I are good friends today.
Yeah.
You know, and even Vince, you know, we stay in touch, and I'm on good terms with WWE. If they need me, I'm happy to be a legend or icon for them. And I'm grateful for everything they did for me, and I just hope that it stays that way.
Well, and it's good, too, because I remember, you know, even I think we had a show in Calgary back in I think it was 2001 or something like that. And I mentioned, you know, you should call Brett. And Vince was like, you know, I miss Brett. I miss him. So it's good that you guys kind of, you know, came to terms and, you know, became friends again, because you guys deserved it. And also on your end, I always thought you deserved a little bit of a better send off in the WWE. And now, like you said, you've kind of gotten that, and you still receive the great reactions whenever you're on the show. And I think that's a good way for you to get the closure from all that and to get some of the reactions that you deserve.
Yeah, we had a falling out at the end, which was, in a lot of ways, took a few minutes to happen, a few hours, maybe a few days.
Right.
And other than that, we had a great, Vince was like a father to me in a lot of ways. And, you know, I'm grateful for everything he ever did for me. And when I look back on my life now, I don't know how to explain it. Maybe it's the same for you, but so many countries, so many characters that I got to meet, and so many great moments, you know, the wrestling, the television moments, and the wrestling moments, and the pay-per-view moments are one thing, but, you know, the little things in the dressing room, the conversations you have with you know, your peers and guys that you respect. And,
yeah.
Well, my whole life was wrestling, and I'm glad I kind of made peace with
No, absolutely.
It's been good for my soul.
One last question. If you had to pick one match, gun to your head, what's your favorite match that you ever had on this day today, one that pops in your head?
My favorite match that pops into my head would be Dynamite Kid in a ladder match in Regina, Saskatchewan for Stampede Wrestling, probably about 1981, 1982.
Wow.
Tore the house down. If you ever met a wrestler named Adrian Street, you could ask him about it, because I remember Adrian Street would get tears in his eyes talking to me, because it was the most greatest match I've ever watched.
Wow.
And that was the ladder match that I kept trying to sell Vince on, to do a ladder match. When Scott Hall and Sean stole the idea from me at WrestleMania 10, it was like, which they did. You know, I went to Vince and I said, I got this idea for a ladder match. I said, but I want you to promise me that you'll never do it with anyone else.
Of course.
He said, okay.
Of course.
Show me what it is. And I said, okay, he goes, pick a wrestler. And I said, okay, I'll pick Sean. So I picked Sean, showed him the match, and I came back, and Vince goes, I missed it. I didn't see it. And then, of course, that was from Sean, if we wrestled at SummerSlam, which we never did. And anyway, Sean stole the idea from me at WrestleMania 10. And I don't know if I've forgiven him for that.
That's the big problem. Brett, thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been awesome talking to you. So many great stories. And once again, like I said, you've always been a hero of mine, and it's great to get a chance to talk to you one-on-one for once.
Well, Chris, I miss talking to you in the dressing rooms. And anytime you want to do this again, just let me know. It's fun catching up with you.
Thanks a lot, Brett. Appreciate it, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care, buddy.
Thanks so much to Bret Hart. Amazing conversation. I'm still going to answer one of your questions. Thanks for tweeting them and using the hashtag TIJQuestions. But before I answer the question, just let me say thank you. Thank you. Thank you for clicking that Amazon banner every time you do any shopping. It helps me help you keep this show a-rolling. The show kept a-rolling all night long. 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 Just go to podcastone.com, click on Talk is Jericho, and hit the Amazon banner. Listen, it's not going to cost you anything more. There's no hidden fees or anything. Just every time you buy something on Amazon using my banner, you access Amazon through Talk is Jericho. Amazon kicks back some money to this show. That's how we can keep it running. I have some hauls here so that my throat doesn't get sore. Hauls cost money, people. I got to pay for these hauls. The best way to do that is if you click on Amazon, I can buy hauls. Maybe I can even buy hauls on Amazon. I can click on Amazon myself. If you can buy a house on Amazon, do it. But do it through the Talk is Jericho link. Go to podcastone.com, click on Talk is Jericho show page, and use my Amazon link. Very simple, people. Love it. All right, here is the question for the week. At that Miguel Lopez from Chicago asks, were you ever starstruck by any musicians that you have met? Yes. Starstruck by James Hetfield. I wrote about this in my third book, which we talked about last week. I met James for the first time in Chicago, incidentally, home of that Miguel Lopez, backstage after his show, and I was so scared to meet him, and I went up to him just like total fanboy. Thank you, James, for all of the music, and I just love your lyrics, and I just think you're the best. And James is just kind of looking at me. I remember he was wearing like this big giant hunting parka. And he's like, oh, thanks, man. No problem. My pleasure. And I was like, oh, thank you so much, James, for everything you've done. And can I take a picture with you? And I took a picture with James. And then afterwards, I had to literally walk into the corner of the room and balance myself so I wouldn't pass out. I felt like I was going to cry. I was like, oh, my God, I just met James Hetfield. Oh, my God, I just met James Hetfield. Oh, my God, I just met James Hetfield. It's like I was so blubbering fanboy. Second time I met him, third time I met him, fourth time I met him. And now I still am kind of intimidated by him, but at least I can have a conversation with him without acting like a dummy. I saw him at the Metallica 30-year anniversary, and he had lost a bunch of weight. And I asked him, what did you do? And he said, the caveman diet. Asked him what the caveman diet was. I then went on the caveman diet and lost about another 15 pounds. Remember when I came back in 2012 after the End of the World as We Know It promos, and I was super ripped? That was because of the caveman diet and because of James Hetfield. So thanks to James Hetfield for helping me through my childhood and helping me not go through my adulthood as a fat bastard. Thank you so much to you for listening to Talk is Jericho. Great, great time hanging out with you guys. Such a blast. Thank you so much for enjoying the show. Keep on listening. Keep on dancing. Stay cool, stay hard, stay hungry. God bless you guys. We will see you next week right here on podcastone.com or iTunes for another fun-filled, tasty edition of Talk is Jericho. Who loves you, baby?
Thanks for listening to Talk is Jericho. Don't forget, every Wednesday there's a brand new episode of Talk is Jericho at podcastone.com.